All right. Welcome to all those that are visiting with us. We're in the middle of a series. We're looking sort of at our mission statement the last several weeks. Follows something called the seven connections. We looked at our personal walk with God, our marriage walk with God, and this morning we're looking at our family walk with God. But in order to do that, I want us to go into the future a little bit. The year is 2408. 400 years from now, and we have to go to a few stadiums this morning. What's the name of the one in Ford Field? Is that what it is in Detroit? How many have been to Ford Field? How many fit in there? What? That's it? I thought Pontiac Stadium held 80,000. So we've gone backwards. All right, well, this is 400 years from now. They've expanded it a little bit. So 80,000 are squeezed in there. And then at the O'Rena in Orlando, there's another 17,000. And then in the Houston Astrodome, anyone know how many fit in? 60,000, I'll just tell you. Chicago's United Center, not really that many, 20,000. Rose Bowl, 105,000 people, okay? Madison Square Garden, 25,000 only. Candlestick Park, 75,000. John F. Kennedy Stadium in Philadelphia, 105,000. Pro Player Stadium, home of the Dolphins, 80,000. How about a BC Place in Vancouver, British Columbia? Have you been there? Anyone? It looks exactly like the Pontiac Silverdome. Exact same thing. 80,000 people. In the Forum of L.A., 25,000. The Sky Dome of Toronto, 85,000. Finally, Lambeau Field. Where? Green Bay, 60,000. Men, women, and children. And all these stadiums, this is 400 years from now, all these stadiums are linked together via satellite and internet and whatever else is in existence in 400 years. And it's all projected on a big, giant screen. 1 million men, women, and children all connected at one time together on a giant screen. And they all have one thing in common. They are all your children. Your offspring. They're all your offspring. And if we were to look at all of these, you know, if we could pan through the crowds, thousands and thousands of people, perhaps we could see your nose. You know? Will your nose get passed on? Or perhaps the way you talk or the way you walk. Or I wonder if something that is in your house, will some of that get passed on? Or will it all end up on the junkyard? The junk heap. Will anything exist from your life 400 years from now? And how about faith? What of the faith that you're passing on now will exist 400 years from now? What of you will last? Having kids, you know, it's really the point, isn't it? To invest in something that will outlast your life. Children are the greatest investment in the future. They're the most costly as well. Nothing will give you more pleasure than your children. Nothing will give you more pain than your children. I remember sometimes peeking in on four little boys, you know, in the middle of the night, they're sleeping, and maybe you've done that too, and they look so peaceful. They have little smiles on their faces as they dream away, and you are filled with the wonder of this. Isn't it great to have children? And then comes the dawn of light and the day, and you wonder, what did we do? And why did we do it? Were we crazy? I mean, it's hard enough for two people to be together, opposites, you know, opposites attract. Two people have a hard enough time getting along together, let alone to add the children. And it's mass chaos, but look how many of us do it. Generation after generation, we keep thinking this might be a good idea. Maybe we think we'll do it better than our parents did. But why do we do it? I think we do it because it's one road to immortality. having children gives you a second chance at life. You know, when the soccer ball goes into the back of the net off the toe of your child, part of that toe is your toe. You just scored a goal. Or when the granddaughter finally gets handed that diploma, part of you got handed that diploma. Having a family not only helps you go deep into the future, it helps you go wide. My parents are 70-something, whatever they are. And, you know, we need a wide-angle lens to take a picture of the whole family. Having a family not only takes up more space, but also gives you sheer numbers in terms of strength. You're not alone as you face the big bad world. You're part of an army that wears the same jeans. Pun intended. Jeans, get it? Jeans, yeah. Tough crowd. Having a family gives you something that depends on you, and one day you will have to depend on. Having a family gives you something to be in charge of, but something you will one day have to let go. Having a family gives you a class that needs you as a teacher, but one day will become the teacher that teaches you. Having a family gives you something to live for, and perhaps more importantly, something worth dying for. Having a family gives you a chance to be a creator, an artist, an immortal, a farmer, a teacher, a nurse, a leader. We are all part of a family in a way that we are not part of something else. You have a father and a mother, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about that. You can ignore them, you can have nothing to do with them, but that will still not change the fact that this person is your mother, this person is your father. You can make a friend not a friend, but you cannot make a son not a son. You are related to each other forever. Look on your outline. It's the mystery of the oneness of family. Genesis 1, 27 and 28. So God created man in his own mysterious image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. Our desire to bear fruit, create, expand, and subdue are all the ways that we reflect God. We want to be like him and do as he does. Those of you with grandchildren perhaps understand in some small way God's desire to watch his children have children. And you also understand how scary that can be. So this desire to be part of a family, and even to create your own family, is sort of hardwired into who we are as God's children. And since God is the author of the whole thing, we also have a built-in desire to have him at the center of our family. There's a story in the book of Acts about Paul and Silas in jail for talking about their faith in public. A miracle happened, and Paul and Silas end up sharing their faith with the jailer. Look on your outline, Acts 16:34. The jailer brought them into his house and set a meal before them. He was filled with joy because he had come to believe in God, he and his whole family. That phrase, he and his whole family, has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? I want more than life itself for my whole family to know God, to know Christ as Savior and Lord. I want to share a common faith, not just for now, but for all eternity. You see, I don't want to ultimately live forever through my children. I want to live forever with my children. Family meets our need to connect with another human being that's part of us. And mysteriously, being connected to others who are connected to God also somehow helps us connect to God. We're designed with this need for connection. That's why it hurts when a teenager, in order to find their own identity, rebels against you. It hurts you, and it hurts the son or daughter. We're not made to fight with one another. That's why it hurts when the kids never call home. That's why it hurts when dad doesn't have time to play with the kids. That's why it hurts when families split up and end up living on opposite ends of the country. We were made to connect, not to disconnect. So, if we are made for this, why is there so much hurt and so much brokenness and pain in families? Look on your outline. There's a connection problem. And then the connection problem is sin. We've been looking at this all along. This problem of hiding in the bushes when God comes around. This problem that Adam and Eve had. They want a nice relationship to one another, but in their nakedness and shame, they need coverings. They need to hide from each other. So we see all this brokenness. They were brothers. The first brothers. They represented the first family. They were the fruit of Adam and Eve. They both had a connection to God, but in a jealous fit, Cain killed his brother Abel. Not a good omen for the institution of the family. When God asked Cain where his brother was, Cain replied, "Am I my brother's keeper?" We want more than anything else to get connected to a family, but sin pushes us the other way. Busy. That's the word that best describes the Henderson family. Both parents work. The kids have school, of course. There's the music lessons, the dance lessons, the taekwondo sessions, the aerobic exercises, school clubs, church clubs, community clubs, sports teams, and practices and games. Each member of the family also has their own individual network of family of friends. Time together in the family is spontaneous and sporadic. The church service is the only event where they actually sit together. But 1 week of sitting on a chair in a church service does not make up for the isolation that they have all week long. They want to be a close family. They want God as the foundation. But in their words, they say, it's just hard these days. Tom is a teenager not doing well at school, not doing well at life either. His parents aren't doing well either. They vacillate between believing that Tom's problems are the result of their parenting and that his problems are the result of Tom. The family's not doing well, and no one can talk about it, let alone do anything about it. John hasn't spoken to his father in 5 years, ever since they had hard words said between the two. The irony is that this event was probably the first time they actually spoke the truth and what was in their hearts. You see, John and his father have never really had much of a relationship. And if you knew a little bit more about John's father's father, you'd understand why. Because John's father, his father, didn't have much of a relationship with John. So John understands this. He understands that his father didn't know how to love him because his grandfather didn't know how to love his father. He understands this. But he doesn't know what to do about it. He finds himself doing the same things. From a distance, the Clarks look like the perfect family. But if you get close, it's very easy to see what looks like a perfect family is just a thin veneer of Christian activity. They know about God, they know about each other, but they don't really know God, and they don't really know each other. They use cliches in dealing with their own relationships. They use cliches in dealing with their relationship to God. It's a protective shield that keeps them from getting relationally hurt. It also keeps them from having a true relationship with each other and with God. As a father, Pete had such a close relationship with his boy. They would talk baseball, toss the baseball back and forth for hours. Pete wanted his son to know and love God too, but he didn't know how to talk about that. Now, years later, his son is divorcing his wife, walking away from God, the church, and his father. But he still plays baseball. We want a close marriage. We want a close family. We want God to be the center of it. And perhaps it's your thirst for this kind of family that is God's grace coming to you. So we have this problem of sin. We're hiding from the very thing that we want. then how do we get out of it? How do we get out of this hiding? You look on your outline, we need a grace connection. We can't do it on our own. We need something, God's grace, to somehow step in. To say she had relational problems would be an understatement. Married 5 times, failed 5 times, currently working on number 6. Then she meets Jesus. The story is found in John chapter 4. Jesus, in his grace, offers her water, living water, to this woman in her relational desert. And God's grace is offered to you this morning to bring new life in your family. It's painful, I think, to be honest about one's family. It's so important to us that we hardly have the strength to take a good, honest look. Maybe the family pain you're experiencing lately is God's grace moving you to do something about that pain. That's what happened to this woman at the well. She was looking for water. She discovers eternal life, but the next thing she knows is her failed life is exposed for all to see. Grace perhaps begins with the truth, and the truth often hurts. That's why we need a Savior, isn't it? One who helps us face our sin, and by His power, through His grace, allows us to get over it. Well, how does this saving power, this grace, get into our families? We've asked this question the last 2 weeks. We have grace. Jesus died on the cross. There it is. But how does it get into our lives? We've been talking about the windy path from John chapter 3, verse 8. The wind blows where it blows. I mean, we don't control the wind. And then that last phrase of that verse, so it is with those born of the Spirit. God's Spirit is something we can't control. We want God's grace. We want God to do powerful things in our lives, but we don't control God. We can't just snap our fingers and say, God, here's what I need. This is what I want. But it doesn't mean we just sit back and do nothing. Though we don't control the wind, we know where it's windy. We know where the wind typically blows. The wind typically blows around a relationship. That's where the wind blows. It blows in our own lives around relationship. You experience grace and forgiveness from the family and friends that you have. How? It's in a relationship. You get to know them. And all of a sudden you discover the grace in your lives. And as we get into a relationship with God, we discover the same thing. Relationships take place in the context of what? 3 things. Talking, listening, repeatedly. You want a relationship with anyone. It takes talking, listening, repeatedly. You want a great family life. It takes talking, listening, repeatedly. And if you want God as the center of your family, it takes some talking and listening repeatedly to God with your family. What is talking to God? Prayer. And what is the most, there's many ways to listen to God. On the way here, you can look at the trees and nature, you can hear God speaking. You can listen to music and hear God speaking through the music. But the most trustworthy, the way that you can count on the most, is through His Word. So family devotions. Listening and talking to God becomes the basis for listening and talking to each other. It's amazing what happens when you invite God to sit at your family table. For example, typical family. There's a set pattern of how you interact. If we could go into each one of your families and sort of map it out, it'd be really interesting. But let me give you a scenario. Not that this is your scenario, but this might be a scenario. Maybe Dad is the kind who's always lecturing. You know, he's always got a lot to say about how things go. Mom is always taking the sides of the children. Some of you are shaking your heads. The oldest child is always rebelling, thinking that they have a better way. The second just keeps his or her mouth shut. They've seen what happens to the oldest. That was the way it was in my family. I was the oldest. I always said something. I got in trouble. My brothers and sisters afterwards realized there's nothing to be gained by saying anything. You can think anything you want, just don't say it. But I always said something. So, do you see that pattern now, even today? Always have something to say. Doesn't matter what it is. And I was always willing to pay the price. Because sometimes you say something and then you lose your privileges. And I was always willing to lose it all. Fine, take the pool. I don't care. Take it all. Take the snowmobile. Because this point I will not give up on. My brother was going, I cannot give up the point, but I still get to keep the snowmobile if I just don't say anything. All right. When you invite God, the all-knowing one, to sit in on your family meeting, you see, suddenly, all of a sudden, Dad is not the all-knowing teacher. Who is? God is. See, God is sitting at the table. Mom is not the only advocate for the kids. God is the advocate for the kids. And the oldest child now has to decide whether they're going to rebel not only against father and mother, but against God himself. And the youngest child? Yes, the youngest child can remain silent and not say a thing, but there's one at the table that knows exactly what he or she is thinking. You see how it's all different when you invite God to sit at your table. Family members, instead of accusing each other and thinking negative things about each other, tend to be more positive. They tend to be more humble, more patient, more willing to confess than accuse, more focused on the positive in family members' lives, not the negative, more determined to make relationships work than to tear them apart. And finally, more focused on how to be a team and how we together as a family, we've been called to be used for God's glory in some kind of a mission. That's who we are together. Now, let me ask you, is there anything more important in your life than your family? Is there something else going on in your life that's more important than that? Is there something more important than your family members and their relationship to God? Is there on that path together? Is there something more important than that? Work, play, whatever it is. See, this is the most important thing in our lives. And the most important, the most basic foundational habit that we could do is family devotions. And yet, many families aren't doing even the basics. This is just the basics. There's many other things that could be added to it. So, how's your family doing? Would you like it to be something better? If you do want a better family life, then we need to talk about your habits. What do you do together as a family on a regular basis? Do you take walks? Do you run together? Do you have a hobby? Do you play games? Do you eat together? Do you work together? Do you spend time together on a regular basis where you can talk and listen to one another? And is somehow talking and listening to God a foundational part of that? If you want God at the center of your relationship, then there must be some talking and listening to God. There are many ways to put God at the crossroads of your family interaction, but probably the most foundational is this devotional habit. So I want to talk about that. The anatomy of family devotions. How would you do that? How does that work? Well, first of all, see, you need a curriculum. You need something that you're going to do. You know, you meet together, now what are we going to do? Let me suggest one thing that you could do is you could talk, first of all, let family members share what they've been praying for on their own, what they've been reading in their own personal life. That's one thing that they could do, you could do. Give them opportunity to express where they're at, their own faith, and give them space to do that. Give them space to wonder about questions and thoughts. You know, how do you know there's a God? You know, kids have all these questions inside of them. That was, I mentioned that I think last week or the week before when we were at the Anne Frank house, you know, in the Netherlands. And her father on a video, you know, she wrote Anne Frank's diary, you know, at 12 years old. All these things, all these personal thoughts about God and people and life and why is this all happening. And her father never knew that she had any of those things. He comes on the video because he's the only one that survived the Holocaust. He comes on and he says, you think you know your kids? You think you know what's inside? You have no idea what they're thinking. Well, let's give them some space to think, to ask, and to wonder. Let them ask questions. Let them ponder God. Let them ask questions like King David did. God, where are you? How could a bully at school be allowed to make things happen? Where is God? I prayed and nothing happened. Well, 10-year-olds have these questions. 10-year-olds are fearful of dying in the middle of the night. And then what happens? They have all these questions. So we need to ask, give them space to talk about their own faith. And then as a curriculum, some maybe Bible reading and prayer, maybe some singing. Especially those of you that have younger kids, maybe even older too. When our kids were younger, it was really easy. We just took the songs of church, and after the meal together, each kid picked out a different song. And they usually, we had four boys, so usually they picked out some kind of banging on the table song. Make a lot of noise. Well, pick out a chapter of the Bible. We have the Bible reading. Maybe you do that together. If you're new here, we have a little sheet. There's a chapter every day. Have you figured out that the first question is for the kids? It's a little harder. And then the second question is for the adults? I don't know. You know, writing these questions, I could be like totally off. I have no idea what works or what doesn't work. So you have to let me know. I have no idea. Sometimes I come up with bizarre questions just to see if you're actually doing it. So far, I haven't got a call, so I don't know. So you... What? You didn't want to offend me. Okay. Go ahead, offend away. Because then I'll get together a team of everyone that complains. I'll get together that team, and they'll be writing the questions. So, you know, you can read the chapter, pray together. In other words, we as a church, we're trying to help you with this. You know, we're doing this all together so as to help you succeed at your home. If you are not reading the chapter every day, if you're not praying with your kids every day, and then you come to church, all I am doing is doing it for you. I'm having a relationship with God for you. That's not going to work in the end. See, if we go 400 years from now, we have the 1 million people in your gene pool, your offspring, they're not going to do what I do. They're going to do what you do. You're the pastor of this group of a million people, not me. You just come here to get a little help. So I'm trying to help you. But it's up to you. At church, what I do is I give you the ball. Hopefully. Here's the ball, here's the ball, here's the ball, here's the ball. And you go home and play with the ball. It's up to you to make this happen in your own life. We'll try to help, support it, but I'm not going to do it for you. That's why we have these chapters. You know, I spent 20 years of my life preaching. No one had any idea what I was going to do. I worked all week preparing it, thinking about it, reading it, studying it, asking God, da, da, da. And everyone else did nothing about it. They had no idea. They'd get to church and go, so what do you got for us today? Last week was okay. The week before, I didn't really like much. Didn't seem like you studied much. Hopefully this week is good. You know, you're in the critic's chair. Now I'm asking you to do it. Did you read it? Did you read this week? Did you pray? Were you talking about it? Thinking about it? See, my job here is just to pull it together a little bit. In fact, I could just hardly do anything because you've done it already. You already know what I'm going to say already. We could get out of here a lot earlier. All right. So you need a curriculum. Second, you need a goal. How often are you going to do this as a family? How often are you going to sit down? Once a day? Once a week? Once a month? Once a year? What are you going to do? How long are you going to spend? Are you going to do 5 minutes? Are you going to do 10 minutes? Are you going to do 15 minutes? What's your goal? Third, in order to succeed with family devotions, you need some kind of schedule. The number one reason, what do you think the number one reason is for people or families not to do family devotions? Too busy, no time. Now, we have 24 hours every single day. That has never changed. You know, people in my grandparents' generation, they had 24 hours. We have 24 hours. So it's not that we don't have time. It's what to do with that time. Now, life has changed. If you are going to be successful at any new endeavor that you get involved in, you sort of have to tie it to something that you're already good at. In the past, I think many of our parents, some of you are raised in Christian homes, they tied this family devotional life to what? to food. And that's a really good thing because it's something that we want every day. It's a habitual thing. We all eat, and we eat every single day. And they tie this devotional thing to eating. So we do it every day, and we do devotions every day. But something happened that changed that. Those of us that are alive today, we have witnessed something that has changed for the first time in the history of the whole world. In the history of the whole world. In our lifetime, we witnessed it, this change, this transformation. And it has to do with food. For all of human history, food was slow. It was really slow. It took a long time to prepare and make and get and canning and cooking. And, you know, it was like an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. I don't know how long it took. But, you know, I was on the tail end of that. So I watched my mother do some of that. She did the cooking in our home, and she spent a couple hours at it. And her attitude was, it took me 2 hours to make this. We're going to be here as a family together, all of us. And we're going to be here a while. We're not just going to come and run, eat and run. We're going to eat together. People used to eat together, and they would eat the same food. It'd be like you prepare one meal, and everyone at the family sits down, and they eat the same meal. There isn't this, well, I don't like this. I want this. No. You ate the same meal. Well, that all changed. Food became fast. What made food fast? Microwave? What else? McDonald's? Fast food. 100 years ago, people, fast, they wouldn't know what it was. Costco has all this stuff that, it's done. You know, it's already finished. You buy it in bulk and stick it in your many freezers at home. And then what happens when you sit down and eat a meal? One kid doesn't like this, so what does he do? Yeah, he goes and makes something else. And we're like powerless to do anything about it. What can we do? We've lost control of our kids. They do whatever they want to do. In fact, they ate an hour before supper time because they found something in the fridge, heated up. You know, that's what it is now, right? And this one's going to... And because food got fast and because it became convenient, everyone can eat when they want. They do eat when they want. And because of that, we have meetings and practices and all kinds of things got scheduled into this slot. There's no free time. Work, play, everything is anytime. When food was slow, the whole world said, hey, we got to take time out to eat, and everything stopped. And the world was ordered in that way. Now, it's all over the place. So what happened as families stopped eating together? What else went out the door? Family devotions. It's interesting. Now let me read Deuteronomy. Look on your outline. Deuteronomy 6:6-9. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your... Impress them. Talk about them. Stop. Talk about them when you sit at home. We need to find ways to sit at the table with our families. Better Homes and Gardens. Richard Swieringer writes in the March issue, time has to be found, say experts, because mealtime is often the only opportunity parents and children have to interact for an uninterrupted hour. And when we miss family dinners, we miss the chance to demonstrate our support for one another, which, with the restorative power of food, is the glue that holds family relationships together and makes life a little better. These are secular people saying, you know, this isn't good. We need to spend time together. Deuteronomy 6 goes on to say, and when you walk along the road and when you lie down, the bedtime ritual, for those of you that have little kids have to be put to bed. It doesn't just happen. You have to bring them to bed. And there's a ritual. You do something. Well, many of us that were raised in Christian homes, part of the ritual of going to bed was what? Saying your prayers and maybe reading a Bible story or two. A Bible story book. So there was this family devotional thing. Corrie ten Boom was a Holocaust survivor from the Netherlands. She came and spoke to my high school back in 73 or something like that. A month ago, my son and I were in Harlem, where she was from, visiting her little town. The church, a big church, is right in the center of town. And then you go around the corner, and you see a watch shop. And this is the watch shop that she lived in, lived above. And it says Ten Boom Watch Shop. It's still there. And you go to this house, and it's kind of a quaint place, and you have to make an appointment, knock on the door, and then a lady comes, and they take you in, and you sit in the living room, and they show you through the place. But she showed us the hiding place where they hid Jews. There was just a little 1-foot by 6-foot area that, when there was trouble, the people that they were trying to protect would hide in there. I have a picture of it. See if that works. That's not it, but there it is. You see what that is? It's just kind of those weights, counterweights, just opened a little door. It was really in a cupboard. You had to crawl, you'd open the door, crawl into the cupboard, and then you can see it's just 1 foot by, and then it went another 6 feet the other way. You know, you get a family in there, and they'd squeeze in there until the trouble would go away. Well, she writes in a book called The Hiding Place. If you haven't read that with your kids, it's a great book to read with your kids. She writes, "My security was assured in many ways as a child. Every night I would go to the door of my room in my nightie and call out, 'Papa, I'm ready for bed.' He would come to my room and pray with me before I went to sleep. I can always remember that he took time with us and would tuck the blankets around my shoulders very carefully with his own characteristic precision." Why did he do it so precise? Yeah, he's a watchmaker. "Then he would put his hand gently on my face and say, 'Sleep well, Corey. I love you.'" Now, as a father, little tiny ritual. Not unlike the little rituals that you may do with your kids. Just a little tiny ritual. And notice it's Papa. A lot of times, I know a lot of families send up Mama. Mama's the one always doing the work with the kids. But it's Papa that comes up. And what is he doing? He's creating this little pathway. Little pathway that he's doing this little thing, and what's happening is this daughter is connecting to father, family, and God, her father. A little ritual that is just connecting the three together. Just a simple little thing. Just a small little thing. You know, at the time you wonder, is this really ever really doing much? It's just a small little thing. And yet later on in life, when she's in this horrid, death-filled concentration camp, she writes, "I sometimes remembered the feeling of my father's hand on my face. When I was lying beside Betsy," that was her sister, "on a wretched, dry mattress in a dehumanizing prison, I would say, 'Oh Lord, let me feel your hand upon me. May I creep under the shadow of your wings.'" Small little thing. Hardly noticeable at the time. Many of you with young kids, you're doing little tiny things and you wonder, well, what's this going to do? Or maybe you're not doing these little things. If you would just add a few little things in your life, a few little habits that somehow connect you to your family members and somehow connect yourself and family to God. Little things. You do on a repeated basis, over and over and over again. And maybe they're sleeping through most of it. Little things. Later on in life, when they face struggles and hardships, those things will come back. Those things will bring their family strength back. Those things will bring God back to them. Well, the family, or the bedtime ritual is fairly simple to do, and it's fairly easy because kids demand it. I mean, a one-year-old has to be put to bed. It's not like you can say, you know what, I'm tired tonight. I don't feel like it. One-year-old, go put yourself to bed. They don't do that. They demand that this must happen. So it's a forced thing. You must do this every single night. You can't take a night off. Every single night. So if you're praying and reading the Bible, you see this ritual goes really well. But what happens when they turn 10, 11, 12, 13 years old? You stop doing that. They stop demanding. Leave me alone. You know? Quit kissing me. So what else stops when the bedtime ritual stops? These little devotional habits all of a sudden stop. So you have to find new ways. That's what happened to Corrie Ten Boom. from the hiding place. She writes, "At 8:45, Father took the old brass-bound Bible from its shelf. He opened to the reading in Jeremiah where he had left off the night before. Father always went upstairs after prayers at 9:50. How long did they do this devotional thing every night? A half an hour. This is what they did for a half an hour every single night. How long does it take to read one chapter of the Bible? If you're the slowest reader in here, how long does it take? 10 minutes? 15 minutes? I think 15 minutes you could actually parse it and look up the Greek, but yeah. It doesn't take a half an hour, I'll tell you that. So how do we, you know, yes, you know, there are certain things that are easy for a season, but then you have to find new ways. What is it going to take to get your family to do devotions together? Every night? Once a week? Once a month? Fourth thing that you need to successfully make family devotions a habit is support. Support. Traditionally, the family has been the most supportive thing, the strongest system of holding people strong, the family. Look here in Nehemiah in your outline. Nehemiah used the family support system to build the walls of Jerusalem under hostile conditions. Nehemiah 4:13. I stationed some of the people behind the lowest point of the wall and at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and said, "Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, and your daughters, and your wives, and your homes." He knew that if I put people by families, they will fight to the death. Why? Because families are strong. Well, they're supposed to be. Families want to be strong, but there are walls that we bump into in terms of our relationships. So let me just give you a few. You can write these down if you'd like. The lack of proximity wall. Families just aren't together that often. If you took two bouncing balls and sent them bouncing in a room, how often would they meet together? You know, once in a while they would collide. Now take four bouncing balls and bounce them in a room. How often would all four be at the same exact spot at one time? That's many of our families. Each person has their own thing. Each person is following their own mission. Each person has their own work, their own school, their own network, their own music, their own way of speaking, their own dress, their own way of doing hair, their own everything. So we have like a home strangers living in a totally different culture from one another. How often are they just going to randomly somehow come together? It doesn't just happen. So really this wall of the lack of proximity is really two walls. It's a wall of priority and planning. First have to make a priority. Our family and being together is a priority. Okay, fine. You've established that. Now you have to plan or it will never happen. These days we live in a sea of options. Everyone has a gazillion options. Because everyone has a gazillion options, everyone goes on their own path. The only way you can get people together is to actually plan and say, this is what my family, extended family, you know, we're trying to meet together in the summer and go camping. We had to finally decide this week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, we're going camping together. We had to decide that 4 months ago. I bet someone backs out before the week is over. The different ages wall. Yeah, you got a 10-year-old and you have a 2-year-old. What do you do? What do devotions look like when you have this age disparity? You got a 17-year-old and a 10-year-old. How's that go? The weakest link wall. When you sit down together as a family, one family member is going to be tired, cranky, distracted, angry, mopey, impatient, in a hurry, uncooperative. One of them. And that one person will tend to drag the whole thing down. The attitude of the whole will be dragged down by the weakest link. Next one, the media wall. There are no joysticks or channel clickers in family devotions. And that's a problem. Because family devotions, compared to these other things, is very slow. How many of you have played, what's the card, one person with the cards? Solitaire. How many of you played solitaire on the computer? Yeah? Do you ever try back with cards again? Have you tried that? And what happens? It's like painfully slow. It's like, man, you got to flip each card. You got to, oh, this is incredibly slow. Because you're used to click, 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 click. And that's the world that our kids are living in. They're in a click, click world. Very quick. Everything happens fast. Now you're going to sit together at the dining table and take out the Bible. We're going to read the Bible. We're going to pray. You know, it's like, slow motion. They're not, you know. They're used to, and there's no images, there's no lights, there's nothing, there's no sound. It's just us sharing our thoughts. How are we going to do that? The yo-yo wall. You feel convicted to do family devotions. You're up, you're motivated. You come up with a challenging plan. In the process of carrying out the plan, you hit a few road bumps. You get discouraged. You're down, you quit. But quitting feels bad. You start feeling guilty. You come up with a new challenging plan and you snap back and you come up to this challenge. But then you bump into some walls again and you quit that plan and you go up and down like a yo-yo. Right after this message, you'll get back at it. We got to do it. The changing family wall. The changing family wall. Your kids are young. You have a great habit going in your family, but then the kids get older, and the same things that you used to do don't work now. The slow progress wall. Succeeding in family devotions is a lot like dieting or exercise. You don't see the results right away. Is anything good happening? We've been doing this for 6 months, and I don't see anything. You know, my kids are still what they are, and my wife still doesn't love me the way she should. And, you know, what's different here? Or the I was not raised with devotions wall. Look, I wasn't raised with this. You were. I wasn't. This doesn't relate to me. Or the blended family wall. I mean, you can come up with your own walls. There are a lot of different walls. All these things. Well, we need support to get over these walls. And the first support is a strong marriage. That's what we talked about last week. If husband and wife are not on the same page with God, how in the world are they going to lead the family? And secondly, the second support is kids. The truth is, kids are an incredible support for family devotions. If you get kids started in a habit, they'll be the ones that remind you. Kids are very habitual. In fact, studies have been shown that kids today lack things that happen on a scheduled basis. That's what they want. They want anchoring points in your life. I want something stable in my life. Because if I have something stable in my life, then I'm free to jump. I'm free to explore. Why? Because there's a place I can come back to. So we want our kids to be able to go out into the world and make things happen, but we need to give them some security from which to spring forth. And third, we need the support of other parents. Families that are trying to do the same thing. We'll talk about that next week. We'll talk about small groups and how we can't do it on our own. This family thing is something that we need to do together. We're in this together. And finally, there's the support that comes from reading and praying the Bible together. The support that God brings in doing that. Okay, then fourth, the fourth thing we need in order to succeed at family devotions is some recognition. Recognition. There again, Philippians, take note of those who live according to the pattern we gave you, Paul says. Take note. How do we take note of families? I mean, we're trying to figure that out as a church. How do we take note of families? You know, some of you kids are filling this out right now. You know, you're sitting there filling out this sheet. What worship song did you enjoy most today? Which person mentioned during the prayer time will you pray for this week? List one passage from the Bible that was mentioned in the sermon this morning. Write about or draw pictures of things that help you remember today's sermon. What do you think God is telling you? And you fill these things out. And then we try to take note of that. Afterwards, you show it to someone and they put a little stamp on it. And then it goes home. And your parents have to look at it and talk about it. And then you get another stamp. Why? Because we're in this together. Things don't happen unless we help one another. So we're trying to do that. And how are we trying to take note with our kids? Well, we've got a table filled with things that they can earn. You know? I don't know how some of you feel about that. Maybe you're a little leery of that. I once paid each one of my kids $150 to read the Bible in a year. I don't know if that's the right thing to do or not, but they read the Bible. How do we take note? Maybe it's not the right thing to do. I don't know. What is the right thing to do? People will do what you take note of. What you recognize is what gets repeated. So how do we do that? How do we recognize and help families? This is the right way. This is the path. Stay on it. Finally, the L factor, or the leadership factor. One thing that will help your family do family devotions, probably more than anything else, is if your family would adopt another family and help them do the same thing. If you could look out into your world and see a family that is hurting, see a family that is broken, see a family that is struggling in their relationship to one another and their relationship to God, if as a family you could adopt them and say, this is the family that we're going to start praying for. And we're going to pray that we can somehow help them. And I'll tell you, if you keep praying that prayer, what will you do with your own family devotion? You'll do it. How are we going to pray for these people if we're not doing it? We better ask them to pray for us. You know, and that's what a small group is. It's a group of people that will pray for you. Because we will try and we will fail. As we do in all relationships. We fail in the most basic relationships that we have. We fail in our marriages all the time, don't we? Some of you on the way to church had a big argument just before you got here. And then you pulled into church. You put the smile on. You're going to church now. Or you had a family thing, you know, getting the kids ready, you know. If you don't get into the car, there'll be hell to pay. Let's go to church. Praise God. That's the way it is. That's the way life is. Life is hard. Relationships are difficult. That's why we need each other. To help one another. I'll tell you, when you become a parent, you know, all of a sudden you start thinking about getting your own act together. You bring a child home and you go, wow, we got to grow up. Well, that's what happens in the family too. You start helping somebody else. They probably help you more than you help them. So what do you say? Shall we do it? Do you sense that in our church, what we're trying to do? We're trying to help one another together? Next week we're going to talk about how we can help one another. Here's your family struggling along, but how can we help one another in these things, in these relationships? Let's pray together. Lord, thank you for this incredible gift that you give us, this ability to create other human beings, that you allow us to do that you trust us enough, as faulty and as frail as we are. And yet you give us this responsibility. And then our kids go out and they reproduce. And think about that million plus people 400 years from now. And we think about what we're doing today and what of all that we're doing will be manifested in those people 400 years from now. Lord, we confess that we mess it up most of the time. But that your grace comes and redeems these things. Even the things that we mess up. Even some of the hard things that we put our kids through because we're weak, because we're sinful, that you can even use those things to make good things and to build good things in our family. So we humbly come to you this morning. We want to be used by you. We want a legacy. But we need your grace in our lives in order for that to happen. And we need the grace of one another, the support of one another. Help us to be that kind of church. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.